few weeks ago, Harvey Weinstein showed up in a New York City bar at an actor's night and was promptly called out with pointed, unapologetic jokes at his expense.
I'm feeling a little tense. Anybody else?
Yeah.
I'm a comic. And it's our job to name the elephant in the room. Do we know what that is?
Yeah,
it's a Freddy Krueger in the room, if you will. I didn't know that we have to bring our own maze and rape whistles to Actors Hour, y'all.
In just a few seconds, stand-up comedian Kelly Bachman became another brave, fed-up survivor of sexual violence, showed a very private pain in a very public venue. She now feels a responsibility to women everywhere, writing in the New York Times that she spent the entire night after that show thinking she had let down other survivors by not punching up harder. That's a familiar feeling for Lucy Decatur, a comedic actress on the Trailer Park Boys, a captain in the Royal Canadian Air Force, and for the past 5 years, known as one of the women who accused former CBC host Gian Gomeshi of assaulting her. What Lucy calls the trial of the century has changed her irrevocably. She still cracks jokes, as she did even on the witness stand as a means of coping, but her humor is darker now. She's still angry, and she feels a responsibility to act on principle, as she did when deciding to leave the Trailer Park Boys in 2016 when one of her co-stars, Mike Smith, was charged with sexual assault. But she is reaching for the light. She just returned from a trek to Everest Base Camp, where she raised $11,000 for Shelter Movers, a charity that helps women and their families leave abusive situations. She loves her cat and going on long bike rides. She is, in a word, doing better. I'm Sarah Bosvelt, and this is The Big Story. 5 years after first speaking out, Lucy Decatur joins us by phone from Halifax. Hi, Lucy.
Hey, Sarah, you are my journalist friend who's followed me through, like, the last 10 years or something like that.
We do go way back. I think the first time I interviewed you was way back in the National Post, just about, like, Trailer Park Boys, you know, Air Force, life. What is this life? Yeah.
I know.
Life has taken us funny places since then.
Hasn't it, though?
Maybe not. Not funny. It's not funny at all.
No, that's the thing. It is totally funny.
Well, and let's talk about some of why we reconnected today, which is really just a comedy club, an actor's night a couple weeks ago in New York City. There was a comedian, Kelly Bachman, who came on stage after noticing in the crowd that Harvey Weinstein was there, you know, the Harvey Weinstein that has been subject to so much exposure of the sexual violence that he's carried out. You know, what did you think when you saw her stand-up clip of her actually just calling out his presence in that club?
Now, to be fair, I didn't see it. I did read about her reaction to it, but I didn't see it because I didn't have the stomach for it. Unfortunately, I do have a little bit of... I have to, for self-protection, I have to put blinders on for some of that stuff, just mm-hmm. because of my own experience with watching people who have got dubious backgrounds rising up. But wow, I mean, if that had been me, like, there's no chance he would have gotten out of there unscathed. No chance. Because if she was able to do stand up about it, she's clearly at a point, or if she's in a place where she's doing stand up again, that means that her resilience has kicked in. And so she has nothing to lose by saying, hey, what are you doing here? So that's something that it's uncomfortable for the person who's there. Sure, sorry, Mr. Weinstein, that you were called out, kind of, except...
Not even by name, right? It was like, there's the elephant in the room, or the Freddy Krueger, as she called it. You know, there's a presence here. In the New York Times, she wrote a piece about why she stood up against him.
Absolutely. And in reading that, there was a lot that, you know, really struck a responsive chord. Because mostly of my experience of having been talking so much publicly about this stuff, and also because of my default to humor, which has sort of followed me my whole life, and just sort of how that all played out, and how she talks about how she lost years of her life to this, her recovery, and lost to something that she shouldn't have lost any time to, and how she walked around with sort of a cloak of shame and regret for not having pushed up. Like she said, she wished that she hadn't pushed up. She wished she had pushed up harder, and that she should have been stronger. And how can you? Like, that's something that no one would ever put on her, but that she put upon herself. And as I was reading it, I was just very much relating and understanding where that comes from, and understanding that it's not productive, and it takes a long time to shake off if you ever do.
Well, tell me, you just said that you have had sort of a default of humor a long time in your life. Tell me about that, you know, and how did that butt up against sort of what you ended up having to deal with 5 years ago now, when you did step forward and said that you had been assaulted?
Yeah, well, my sense of humor shifted for sure. I've always had a fairly raucous sense of humor, and definitely defaulted into sexualizing things that are not sexual, because it sort of, the ludicrousy of it became funny. But that immediately has shifted quite a lot. Like, I definitely lean pretty hard into a "that's the name of your sex tape" kind of joke, but sexualized humor is mostly off the table. Mm-hmm. And also, I will talk very bluntly about a lot of things that I wouldn't ordinarily have, and then just twist it a little bit so it's funny, but I'm still talking about sexual assault. I talk about sexual assault every day at some point, which I had never done before. And it's not even so much because of my experience directly with sexual assault, but with talking about sexual assault. Mm-hmm. And part of that is because, like, I don't even understand why consent is a conversation. I just don't get it. I don't know why it's a conversation. I don't know why it's obscure and vague. I don't know why people don't get it. I really don't know. I also feel like once I started to talk about sexual misconduct and sexual assault in a public realm, I just can't, like, it's irresponsible to not. It sort of now feels like an act of service.
Interesting.
And I had such a thick layer of shame on me that came from, well, the lawyer that I was up against at the trial, that when I peeled it off, it's like still feels like, you know how when you peel off a scab, it's super satisfying, but then underneath it, there's this rawness, and that's something that I still carry and will, not sure when that will fade, if ever.
Having the blend of anger and humor is really interesting to me, you know, to actually use it as a tool to wake people up, I guess, in a way, or just to respond in a way that feels like you can cope throughout that. I mean, that's what was so compelling about Kelly's response, right? She was just like, I use this tool that I have, this mechanism that I have to help call this out, and I still don't feel like it was enough. You know, that sounds like it familiar to your experience too.
Yeah, absolutely. It wasn't enough. Like, after, can I just call it the trial of the century? After the trial of the century, I just felt so terrible. I didn't expect that the perp was going to go to jail. That wasn't why I was so devastated. I was so devastated because I told you this. I know it. I told you this directly, that I felt like I just let everybody down. Mm-hmm. And I felt like I was striving for some kind of perfection in this trial. I don't even know what that would look like, but I felt like I had some kind of armor around me. And then as soon as I got in there, I realized that that was not going to serve me. And I was dealing with someone who is a millionaire, who was being paid probably close to $1 million to make me seem like a crazy person. And so what could I possibly have expected? That was what was kind of devastating. I felt like the shame that had been imposed, and that was strategic, and that was done purposefully by the team that I was against. Yeah, it took a long time to shake. And when I say shake in the past tense, just for fun, we can keep it in the present tense, because it's stuff that hits me at, like, during the wee small hours if I have a hard time falling asleep, just because of sometimes insomnia hits all people. And that trial floats in front of my mind's eye more often than is comfortable. And then I remember immediately afterwards, I felt like it was my duty to wander around the streets of Toronto and talk to strangers, most of whom were women, most of whom, as soon as they saw me, were literally brought to tears and wrap themselves around me and cry. And I felt like that was a sentence I had to bear, which is a little bit weird. And I don't know where that came from.
Well, you wrote a Facebook post on October 26th, which was a 5 years since Giacometti was fired from the CBC for, you know, showing the videos to his employers, you know, of sexual misconduct, essentially. And, you know, you talked in that piece, like, it was such a mix of, like, anger, you know, a lot of anger that you have. And then, but also just like, I'm reaching for the hope. I'm reaching for the lighter things. I'm trying to do something with this. What headspace are you sort of in now?
Well, better for sure. Last year, I was starting to, almost a year ago, after Christmas, or around Christmas time, I was starting to feel like I had a bit of energy after having been absolutely depleted. I was starting to feel like I had a little bit of energy, and I was like, what am I going to do with this? Something good has to have come from all of this terribleness. What am I going to do with this energy? And my friend was with me while I was talking with her about this, and I was like, what am I going to do? Like, go to Everest Base Camp and raise a bunch of money for a charity I've never heard of? And she just looked at me and she's like, sucker. Yeah, you are. And so a few weeks ago, I came back from trekking to Everest Base Camp and raising like $11,000 for a charity that up until last December, I'd never heard of.
And tell me about the charity. What is it?
It's called Shelter Movers. And the reason why I chose Shelter Movers is because they help women who, once they've realized they need to leave a dangerous, unsafe relationship where violence is being used, and they found a place to go, how do they get there without leaving everything behind? How do they get there safely? So Shelter Movers fills that gap and will move people at no cost to the individual, and they'll move their stuff, and they'll move their kids, and they'll move their dogs, and get them into a safe place. And so this, to me, was a fantastic allegory, because people, once they know that's there, it helps them get from one place to another. And before I looked into it, I thought that Everest was completely unattainable for me to get to base camp. And then I did a little research exploration, and I was like, actually, if I get a little bit of help from some local folks who are living in the Everest region, I can get to base camp. And so I also, through my whole recovery, leaned really hard into Angela Wong's book on grit. And I thought about grit as resilience. And a lot of times, if you just keep showing up with deliberative practice, or in my case, if I just keep every day do something that invests in my future, eventually I'm going to be okay. And then I knew coming down from the mountain, I'd be like kind of bummed out. For me, Halloween is ruined.
Yeah. Halloween being the day that Giacometti was arrested 5 years ago. That was the day.
Actually, he wasn't arrested that day. He was arrested later. At Halloween, around that time, was when we knew that he had been fired rather than was on a leave of absence. Mm-hmm. And that's when my story became public. And I was like feeling kind of despondent and hopeless. And I didn't have any curiosity and I wasn't interested in anything. And I was like, oh God, winter is coming. Mm-hmm. What am I going to do? So I found a constructive outlet to help me face phobias that I have, to offer fun in my life, to reintroduce curiosity. And that's very simply embracing winter through mountain biking, mm-hmm. which is something that doesn't matter to anybody else. It's really just for me. This isn't for Shelter Movers. It isn't for anything else. This is my own thing. And it's the first time, apart from doing tangible recovery so that I could get out of the house every day and not get destroyed just by walking down the street. Now I'm at a better place where I can like start to find health and happiness on my own terms and also without people watching.
Yeah. Obviously, Giacometti's tried to have two comebacks since the 5 years ago. Do you, like, it's going to happen again. Like, what do you, I mean, is it telling that, like, the past two times it really was just shut right down? And what do we do with that when it eventually happens, you know? Like, speaking of calling things out and having that courage, but also that self-care and compassion around it, too.
Okay, so say somebody is a serial, violent sex offender. They still need to have an income and a job. That's fine. And they can do that. However, if that person enjoyed a voice in the public sphere, they don't get that back. that isn't earned.
That's the cost.
That has been forfeited. Both Gian Gomeshi and Harvey Weinstein, unemployed, are more liquid than I am, gainfully employed. They're fine. They can pay the rent. I'm making wild presumptions here. Maybe Harvey Weinstein can't pay the rent. I don't know. But he can work in lots of different things. Does he need to have access to a voice that he sort of squandered? Absolutely not. And his voice isn't welcome by half of the population, probably more, because he used it wrongly. And also about, Gomeshi, he can have a job, for sure, but probably a different line of work would be a better shot. And I've said this before, there is a way, no matter how broken something is, there is a way for healing, and that is having a safe, probably moderated conversation between the people involved. Like, say Harvey Weinstein called up lady number 7 and said, hey, I want to have a talk with you about what happened. And I want to have it in a way that's safe for both of us so that we can talk through this and find a way for healing. And for me to offer an actual apology and listen to how this impacted you and how I can learn from it and have me learn from each other, that'd be amazing. Anytime I encounter someone who happens to be in the courtroom, I feel like they saw the most terrible thing ever. I don't think anybody came out of that courtroom untouched. And I just, back to, like, I remember being in the courtroom and I could hear the protesters outside yelling. And it should have offered comfort, but it was just shattering. Because, like, why were they so upset? And that, for some reason,
why were they so upset?
I mean, I knew literally why they were so upset, but, like, why were they touched by it? Whenever I hear that somebody has been touched by the story, for some reason, it bums me out.
Well, it kind of indicates that this violence continues and is so personal and resonant to so many women, right?
Yeah, maybe that. Maybe so. Yeah. But there's something about, this is totally off topic, but there's just something about when people come up to me and they say that my involvement with the trial helped them in a positive way and helped them get out of a bad relationship or whatever, instead of being boosting, I find it devastating.
And how would you meet that when people said that? Would you kind of like make a joke or what? How do you even respond to that? You know, and the idea of sort of coping with that huge responsibility and that expectation that has been placed on you.
I found a way to cope with that very early where I just hug them and I just tell them that's a lot. That sounds like a lot. And then they can impose onto that phrase whatever they need to. But I have to try to, I mean, I'm definitely compassionate to their circumstances, but I cannot absorb it. For some reason, there's a real, it makes me really sad. And it's not, I'm not a good enough person for me to necessarily be sad for them.
Like, why do you think that you and I imagine Kelly too become this, mm-hmm. like, yes, you're out in the public, but why do you become a place where women can like tell you all of those things? Like, you become a vessel for a lot of pain, you know, like how,
mm-hmm. yeah.
Why do you think that has happened?
Maybe it was my own design. When I first started talking about this stuff, I was as transparent as I could muster because already like 100,000 people had said that the women who allegedly were assaulted by Gian Gomeshi were lying. And I was like, well, if I'm going to talk about this in the press, I have to be as transparent as possible. I have to be really raw so that people pick up what I'm throwing down about the authenticity of the situation and about the size of the situation.
Yeah.
And maybe I think that's why also because in a situation which, again, demands this perfection of the witness that's able to take the story above the shadow of a doubt, they saw all of the typical reactions to trauma that I demonstrated, and it struck a response of court.
Well, people recognize too, like you sitting there in that courtroom, and I saw the way that, you know, your humor, your, you know, desire to continue talking, like that all got worked against you in a lot of ways, right? Like I'm interested in that idea even today, you know, with Kelly talking on that stage, you know, her humor, like there were people booing, right? Like, don't be, you know, don't use like humor to talk about something really difficult, or don't react in that way because that is not deemed appropriate. And you know, in the way that we talk about these issues, right?
Absolutely. And I've, you know, relied on my voice a lot. And when I walked into the courtroom, my voice was taken from me. And while I was there to speak the truth, I was not actually given the room to speak, A, because I was offered very little direction from the Crowns. I just was told that things had to be black and white. So I was like, okay, well, it's a yes or no answer. And then when the team that I was being interrogated by were asking me questions or pointing things at me, they were ludicrous and had nothing to do with it. So I just tried to be as gracious as possible. But a couple of times I cracked in the sense that I would sometimes phrase my answers in a way that were a little bit funnier because I needed to release the steam. And because the things that she was presenting to me, I mean, often they were my own voice. And yeah, there was a ludicrousy to it, but like, I was literally joking.
So like your humor got kind of used against you in a way. It was sort of co-opted as a tool. Like, I'm interested in how do you reclaim that? You know, how do you kind of say, look, this is, as you reach for a lot more hope and light, you know, how do you kind of reclaim that dimension of you that has been so important, your humor, your light, you know, how do you do that now going forward 5 years later?
I have to find, I find other dark things to joke about. And so my mother died really recently.
I'm so sorry.
And that invites a whole very dark world of hilariousness. I have her wedding ring, which I wear every day. I feel like I'm taking care of it for her. Yeah. Spoiler alert, she doesn't need it. So I dropped it in the change room at the gym the other day, and somebody heard it. I didn't hear it drop because I was listening to headphones. And she's like, oh, it's right there. And she picked it up. And I was like, oh, that's great. It's just my dead mother's wedding ring. No big deal. She's like, oh, my God. A little grim. I mean, it's true. It is my dead mother's wedding ring. It is true. But when it's phrased like that, it's sort of hilarious and tragic at the same time.
Well, and that's kind of the world we're living in now, too, right? Just hilarious and tragic and dealing with these things, you know, just the ludicrousness of things continuing as they are with some hopeful pieces of change, you know? And I think you've contributed to that in so many important ways, Lucy. So thank you.
Thank you so much as well. And I hope you have a happy day.
Lucy Decatur from the Trailer Park Boys is a captain in the Royal Canadian Navy and an advocate calling for an end to sexual violence. That was a big story. For more from us, go to thebigstorypodcast.ca or on Twitter at @thebigstoryfpn. Jordan's back tomorrow. Thanks so much for listening.